even for himself. They weren't zookeepers, after all. But it wasn't natural causes that had endangered 38, and this made the decision less clear-cut. They ultimately decided not to interfere, though Smith flew over the gorge once a day to track the wolf's progress. After a few days, 38 had scarcely moved from his original location, though the collar indicated that he was still alive. Unable to hunt and isolated from his pack, he was in all likelihood beginning to starve to death. It was bad enough to lose a wolf to some elk hunter's fleeting impulse. 38, alone, at the bottom of that ravine, slowly dying, was too much for Smith. He took a helicopter up and dropped meat into the gorge, hoping 38 would find it. It took 11 days for the wolf to die. When Smith retrieved his body, the druid's former leader, a hefty 122 pounds when he was introduced into the park, weighed just 88. The perpetrator was never found, though suspicion fell on a local hunter. Not long after the druids returned to the Lamar Valley, a veteran wildlife cinematographer named Bob Landis spotted a young black wolf moving cautiously toward the pack. Taciturn and endlessly patient, Landis had spent nearly as much time in the Lamar Valley as Rick, whom he had known since his Denali days and often relied on to find the wolves he filmed. The visitor was 21, a 2-year-old from the Rose Creek pack. He'd been roaming in recent months, eager to leave his natal pack and begin a family of his own, but his appearance in Druid territory was a surprise. The Rose Creek yearling that the Druids had killed just a year before had been one of 21's own littermates. But fortune had always been kind to 21. The fact that he had lived to adulthood at all was something of a miracle. He was one of the 8 rescued offspring of the ill-fated 9 and 10, recovered from the makeshift den near Red Lodge and returned to the park by Doug Smith. Although he could never be sure, Smith had always suspected that Lucky 21 was the last pup found on that unforgettable day when he'd returned for one last look to the talus pile in which the pups had holed up. Groping blindly on his knees, shoulder deep in a crevice, he had felt something soft just beyond his grasp. The pliers on his pilot's leatherman gave him the extra inch of reach and the purchase he needed to pull the squirming, yelping pup from the hole. Now, 21 was a robust and adventuresome adult, the very picture of an alpha. If he could find a place in the northern range where such a wolf was needed. The druids had lost 38 and their beta male only a few days earlier, but something, perhaps the family's collective howl, diminished as it now was, had told 21 that the pack's adult males were gone. That didn't mean the remaining druids weren't dangerous. This was especially true of 40, the alpha female, who ran to meet 21 on a snowy hillside not far from the river as Landis watched through his camera's viewfinder. She was a slender gray, unimpressive in stature, especially nose to nose with the hulking black intruder, but notorious for her ill temper. She had risen to leadership in a push of her own design, driving out her mother, the former alpha female, who had been reduced to forlornly following her brood, scavenging at whatever scraps she could find. 40 was equally hard on her 2 sisters, constantly reminding them of their inferior status. Largely symbolic in most packs, pinning an underling was an activity that the snarling 40 undertook with uncommon enthusiasm. Now she advanced on 21 with her sisters in tow. The male retreated, but not far. When he turned to face the females, it was with his tail raised high. He didn't want to fight, but he wasn't afraid either. With his camera rolling, Landis watched from the roadside in quiet fascination as 40 and her sisters chased him across the hillside for hours, seemingly on the verge of attacking, but always stopping short. The 5 pups, anxious and unnerved, looked on from a distance. The confrontation had shifted from a territorial challenge to a ritual of sorts, one seldom observed in the wild and never before filmed. The new male was being tested, Doug Smith would say later, to see if he possessed that ineffable combination of qualities that make an alpha. Had 21 been found wanting, he would have been lucky to escape without injury. As it happened, the choreography of the encounter gradually took on the trappings of play. The male bowed, his forelegs spread wide and his head near the ground, and the sisters leaped forward. He hopped aside, and they turned with him in delight, nearly skipping as they took off running together, like a pack. Eventually, one of the females put a paw across 21's back, and he allowed it to remain. His lips split wide in a canine grin. When the pups finally joined in, they jostled one another for a chance to lick at 21's jaw from below, wagging their tails as they had for 38, as though they had known the newcomer all their short lives. Thus began 21's tenure as alpha male of the Druids. His reign lasted 6.5 years. Though his partnership with 40 didn't survive nearly that long. The problem lay in the delicate politics of breeding. A wolf pack is essentially a family, typically consisting of a breeding male and female, known as the alpha pair, along with yearlings from the previous spring's litter, and a few 2 or even 3-year-old offspring who have yet to leave home. Wolves breed only once a year, and are reluctant to do so with their own offspring, which means that usually only the alpha pair will mate. When an unrelated male joins a pack, however, other combinations become possible, and 21 showed interest not only in 40, but in her 2 sisters. For the first 3 years after 21's arrival, 40 prevented her sisters from breeding as best she could, savaging them at every opportunity. They rarely, if ever, fought back, submitting to her attacks by rolling over and showing their stomachs. If any pups were born to 40's sisters, they didn't survive. It was possible that the alpha had killed her rivals' litters, though project biologists couldn't be sure. Meanwhile, 40 produced few pups of her own, and the pack's numbers grew only modestly. That changed in the spring of 2000, when 21 managed to impregnate a sister known as 42, along with her adult daughter, even as he sired pups with 40 herself. He divided his time between 3 dens spread across the valley, each about 3 to 4 miles apart. One evening in May, while away from her den on a hunt, 40 came upon 42, who was also out hunting with another female for company. As Rick watched through his scope, 40 delivered a vicious attack, forcing both the wolves to submit. She then followed the pair back toward 42's den, where her pups, barely a month old and still defenseless, were being watched by a third female. Rick and his colleagues feared the worst. The next morning, he spotted a female wolf near the road, so wounded she was barely moving. But to his surprise, it wasn't 42. It was 40. She was bleeding from bite wounds, including one that had severed her jugular artery, and she died shortly after she was found. On closer examination, project biologists found that she had been bitten all over, almost certainly by multiple attackers. The savagery of the attack was startling. Doug Smith discovered a hole in the back of 40's neck deep enough to sink his index finger all the way to the knuckle. Sometime during the night, the long-suffering druid females had apparently decided they'd had enough. It was the first documented instance of a pack's subordinate members killing their own alpha. 40's pups were now motherless, and their future was in doubt. Would they be killed along with their mother? As Rick and his colleagues looked on in amazement, 21 supervised the relocation of the far-flung litters, consolidating the pups, 21 in all, into one massive brood. 42 rose to become the new alpha female, and suddenly harmony reigned in the pack as all the females worked together to raise the enormous litter. Even under normal circumstances, keeping pups fed, healthy, and safe from predators is a struggle, and mortality rates of 50% are not uncommon. Yet an astounding 20 of the Druid pups survived to adulthood, ushering in a golden era for the pack. 21 continued to breed with multiple females, and by August 2001, the pack had grown to 37 wolves, roughly 3 times the size of the next largest pack in Yellowstone. The Druids became the dominant force in the northern range, expanding their territory and winning battle after battle with neighboring packs. 21 had become a kind of Abraham of Yellowstone wolves, siring more pups than any alpha before or since. The entire Druid saga played out in the wide-open landscape of the Lamar Valley, and some of the most astonishing action happened in full view of the Park Road, to the delight of both researchers and visitors. Wolves had already been among the world's most studied animals prior to the reintroduction, yet there was so much more to learn. This was especially true of predation. In the project's first decade, researchers in Yellowstone witnessed an unprecedented 100 wolf kills. Employees who lived in the park watched wolves run down elk in their own front yards. Yellowstone had become a place where you might see something out your kitchen window that researchers elsewhere waited years to observe. The Yellowstone Wolf Project's offices were in the park headquarters in Mammoth, not far from the northwest entrance near Gardner. When he was first hired, Rick's job was to organize talks at the Mammoth Visitor Center. But every chance he got, he drove 30 miles east to the Lamar Valley to look for wolves, usually the Druids, with the project biologists. He knew he was supposed to be talking to visitors, but the excitement of following wolves around the valley as they made their first kills and established their territories was irresistible. As a sort of compromise, he began approaching any visitor he happened to see in one of the park road's various pullouts as he was scanning the mountainsides with his scope. "Hello, my name is Rick McIntyre," he told them. "Would you like to see a wolf?" With only a few dozen wolves in the park in these early years, visitors had virtually no chance of seeing one on their own. But with Rick's help, they could. Soon, word got out, and Yellowstone's traffic enforcement rangers found themselves dealing with overflowing parking lots in spots where normally there would be only a handful of cars. Park management was not pleased. Wolf reintroduction was about making an ecosystem whole. It was never really supposed to be a tourist attraction, and everyone had assumed the wolves would be too difficult to spot in any case. Now, thanks to Rick, visitors were trampling the sage to get a better view of history in the making. Rules were being broken, and wolves, from the perspective of some park employees, were becoming a hassle. Rick's supervisor urged him to stick to his assigned duties, but nothing he told his new charge seemed to deter him. It wasn't Rick's first conflict with park service management. With over 20,000 employees, the service was as bureaucratic and hierarchical as any agency of the federal government, though Rick found that some bosses were more hidebound than others. A few would have been right at home in the U.S. Army. Rick once sat in the back row at a meeting of interpretive rangers while a supervisor demonstrated in surprising detail how pens were to be carried while on duty. Rick himself was not a stickler for rules. He had been issued a green clip-on tie, though he never wore it. The Park Service gave rangers a yearly allotment to spend on uniforms, but Rick tended to wear his until they were threadbare, and sometimes beyond. He had repaired the crotch of a particularly comfortable pair of green government-issued jeans with dental floss. In an effort to rein him in, the Park Service assigned Rick to the visitor center near Old Faithful, 70 miles from the Lamar Valley. The main attraction in that part of the park, of course, was the geyser itself. It could be counted on to go off every 90 minutes or so, and the park kept visitors apprised of the estimated time of the next eruption on a chalkboard in the viewing area. If they had a little time to kill, families might get ice cream or wander into the auditorium during Rick's slideshow on wolves. The pictures were interesting, but there would be a great deal of watch-checking in the audience, and periodically a mass exodus would occur to get a good spot to watch the eruption. It was like trying to do stand-up comedy at a nightclub with the Super Bowl playing on the TV above the bar. Rick could have had slides of an alpha female giving birth in a den while her mate wrestled grizzlies outside in an ice storm, and it wouldn't have made a difference. Old Faithful was Old Faithful. He was also required to conduct wolf walks through the woods near the visitor center, in which he discussed the role wolves played in Yellowstone's ecosystem. To his frustration, there were no wolves in those woods, nor anywhere else in the vicinity of Old Faithful. They were all still in the northern range. In the calculus of the Park Service, that was of little consequence. Old Faithful was where the visitors were, so this was where Rick needed to be. One afternoon, a boy asked him, "Are we going to see wolves on this walk?" Rick had to admit that they would not. "Why not?" the boy wanted to know. "Because there aren't any wolves in this part of the park," Rick replied. "Then why are we doing a wolf walk here?" the boy asked. "Someday," Rick wanted to tell him, "you'll have a boss, and you'll know the answer to that question." What tortured him wasn't just that the Druids were so far away. It was the knowledge that if he had been conducting his talks in the Lamar Valley, his audience wouldn't have to be content with mere slides. They might actually see wolves. Still, he wasn't going to let the distance keep him from seeing the animals himself. Rising long before dawn, he made the tiresome drive, an hour and a half each way on the park's roads, where the speed limit was only 45. To the Lamar Valley, and back every day, returning in time to do his talks at Old Faithful. Sometimes he arrived in the evening instead and slept in his car so he would be in the valley at first light. Eventually, after 4 summers of frustration, Rick's superiors in the naturalist division gave up and transferred him to the biology department. His new boss was Doug Smith. Immediately after Rick's transfer, Smith received a warning from his own boss. Ranger McIntyre, he said, was essentially unsupervisable. But he was Smith's problem now, and the boss made it clear he considered the matter closed. "If I hear the name Rick McIntyre again," he said, "you're in trouble." Rick liked and admired Smith, and he was happy to leave the crowds at Old Faithful behind. His new job was to help the Wolf Project keep tabs on the wolves in the northern range, mostly in the Lamar Valley. He became a key spotter for the annual winter study, in which teams of researchers, often graduate students, were brought in to follow each pack intensively for 30 days, documenting the wolves' daily movements and hiking out to investigate every kill after the wolves had finished eating. Smith was impressed with Rick's fieldwork and his encyclopedic knowledge of wolves and their habits, but he wanted Rick to keep talking to park visitors, too. Now that it was clear that wolves weren't going to leave the valley, visitors inevitably were going to interact with them, especially as their numbers grew. Smith needed someone to help manage that interaction, to make sure visitors didn't approach wolves or disturb dens, or park along the road in areas where wolves were likely to cross. If Rick could help people understand wolves in the process, and help shape the new and rapidly growing phenomenon of Yellowstone wolf watching, Smith figured all the better. He hired Rick on as a permanent employee in the spring of 1999. For the first time in 24 years, Rick spent a summer and a winter in the same place. Once he became a full-time Yellowstone resident and settled into his daily routine of watching the Druids, Rick found that he didn't want to do anything else. Strictly speaking, he worked only 40 hours a week, but he came to the park every morning regardless of whether he was on the clock. When he wasn't officially on duty, he didn't wear his uniform. Otherwise, there was no difference in his daily routine. He didn't take vacations, and he rarely got sick. He would occasionally get offers to speak on wolves at various conferences around the country, but he always turned them down. His work in the park was too important. In June 2000, he took a short trip to Massachusetts for his mother's funeral. Although he didn't realize it at the time, it would be the last time he ever traveled any real distance from Yellowstone. It wasn't that he'd made a conscious decision not to leave again. It just sort of happened that way. His father, an engineer at AT&T, had died of a heart attack when Rick was 10, and his mother, a homemaker, had never remarried. His only sibling, Alan, was 6 years older, and the two were not close. For the next 15 years, the farthest Rick ever ventured from the park was an occasional evening trip to the nearest movie theater, 75 miles away in Cody. He never missed another day watching wolves. If he did skip a day, who knew what he might miss? The celebrated primate researcher Jane Goodall didn't even have a college degree when she was assigned to watch chimpanzees in Tanzania, Rick liked to remind people. Yet she was the first to record them using twigs as tools for fishing termites out of the ground, a discovery that upended the conventional understanding of primate intelligence. She had been in the field for months, much longer than any other observer, before she witnessed that startling behavior. And yet if you had approached her the day before she made that discovery and asked her if a chimp was smart enough to use a tool to get what it wanted, she would have said no. It was all about showing up. In the park, meanwhile, the wolves of the Lamar Valley were putting on a never-ending show that as many as 30,000 visitors per year were witnessing. Guide services catering to wolf watchers sprang up in Gardner, near the northwest entrance, and cabins and motels near the park saw increased bookings even in the low seasons. Wolf tourism was booming. In 2003, the National Geographic Channel aired Bob Landis's documentary on the saga of 21 and 42. The film, which won an Emmy, was so popular that Landis eventually made two more about the pack. President Bill Clinton came to see the wolves, as did a string of celebrities, whom Doug Smith dutifully shepherded around the park, relying on Rick to make sure everyone got to see a wolf. Rick's favorite such occasion was a visit from Cameron Diaz and the rapper DMX for an environmentally themed MTV show. DMX, who was raised in Yonkers, had trouble adjusting to the scale of Yellowstone. "I had no idea any of this was even here," he marveled. By then, wolf reintroduction was being called the greatest wildlife conservation success story of the last 50 years. The men and women who made it happen had become celebrated figures in the insular world of wildlife biology. Mike Phillips, the original project leader, had been hired away from the Park Service by Ted Turner to head the Turner Endangered Species Fund in Bozeman, and was eventually elected to a seat in the Montana State Legislature. Doug Smith, who succeeded Phillips as director, published a pair of books about the project, and was in considerable demand as a speaker at conferences around the country. Perhaps the unlikeliest hero was Carter Niemeyer, who had come to admire the animals despite his decades-long career as a government trapper. His wolf-skinning story had become a treasured part of the lore of reintroduction, and he'd since gone on to become the head of Fish and Wildlife's Wolf Office in Idaho. As the years went by and Yellowstone wolf watching became a full-blown phenomenon, Rick became something of a celebrated figure himself, with all the perks and headaches that appertained. Visitors interested in seeing wolves learned by word of mouth that their best course of action was to look for Rick's yellow Nissan Xterra. He wasn't hard to find. Only one road transected the park's northern range, where viewing was generally best and where he spent most of his time. "That's the wolf guy," people would whisper as they spotted him standing near his scope. Rick never quite got used to being followed, but he grew resigned to the routine. If he so much as paused in a pullout or parking lot, it was just a matter of time before one car would stop, then another. Soon a dozen cars would be squeezing in. Like a grizzly or a bald eagle or any of the park's traffic jam-inspiring attractions, he had been sighted. Once he began staying in Yellowstone year-round, Rick came to know the Druids' homeland intimately. The pack routinely covered 20 miles in a day, and Rick learned to move with them, methodically making his way across the Lamar Valley until he'd located their signals. On the eastern end of the valley was massive Mount Norris, beyond which lay the park boundary, and, farther still, Crandall. At the foot of Norris was a wide, flat alluvial plain, where the Lamar River dropped down from a high plateau in the park's interior and was joined by a trout stream known as Soda Butte Creek, tumbling in from the northeast. Druid Peak, the mountain for which the pack was named, overlooked the confluence of the two streams from the north side of the valley. Moving downstream, the river flowed through a classic U-shaped glacial valley, dotted here and there with boulders and small ponds left behind by the retreating ice. Heavily wooded Specimen Ridge, named for the abundance of petrified wood found on its flanks, stretched along the entire southern side of the valley. The ridge dropped down toward the river in a series of broad, grassy benches, the largest of which, called Jasper Bench, was a favorite hunting ground for the Druids. A series of more or less treeless ridges formed the opposite side of the valley, which narrowed at its western end to a modest gorge known as Lamar Canyon, before opening back up again as the river flowed through Little America. About halfway down the valley's length, on the northern side, was a small cluster of buildings known as Buffalo Ranch, which included a ranger station and a classroom where wildlife classes were taught. All this was Druid country. Rick grew accustomed to the natural rhythms of the wolves' existence. Winter was a time for roaming, as the Druids patrolled the full width and breadth of their territory, scent-marking the borders with urine, and following the various elk herds that didn't migrate out of the park. The pack was at its most cohesive in these months, traveling and hunting together as a group. In the spring, 21 and 42 became inseparable, and Rick learned to watch for the telltale signs of another litter on the way. 42 would begin visiting the pack's den in a thickly wooded dale on a shoulder of Druid Peak, preparing it for an extended stay. In early summer would come the first sightings of the pups, and the excitement of counting how many had been born, and the parsing of coat color and gender, so difficult to determine through a spotting scope. Around midsummer, the alphas would move the family from the mountain down onto a favorite spot on the valley floor. It was at the base of Specimen Ridge, about a mile south of the river, where a minor creek came down amid a large fan of boulders and other detritus, evidence of what was once a larger watercourse. Such gathering points, known as rendezvous sites, are typically used by packs whose pups have grown large enough to leave the den area, but not yet quite sturdy enough for the endless roaming that comes with winter. With secrecy no longer quite so essential to the pup's survival, the alphas usually choose a more open area with better access to prey. Watching the Druid alphas move their pups from the den to the rendezvous became a favorite summertime ritual for wolf watchers who took advantage of a parking lot near the base of the mountain to observe the action. Since the den was on the north side of the park road, and the rendezvous site was on the south, the journey included a highly visible crossing of the blacktop, usually the pups first, which in turn meant that everyone was able to get a close look at the youngsters for the first time. Though the annual relocation was a distance of only perhaps 2.5 miles, it was a major undertaking. Besides the road, the pups also had to cross Soda Butte Creek. Especially if the previous winter's snowpack had been high, the creek could be dangerously deep and fast-moving. Getting across alive was a rite of passage for every Druid pup, and a moment of high drama for the watchers, complete with cheers every time a drenched youngster dragged himself up, spooked and bedraggled, onto the far bank. By the fall, the pups were almost as big as the adults and beginning to accompany them on short hunting excursions until winter came and the pack was free to roam en masse once more. The composition of the pack was constantly in flux. Pups became yearlings, yearlings became adults, and wandered off to seek their fate, some to eventually return, others never to be seen again. The one constant was 21 and 42. Rick never tired of watching the alpha pair, especially 21, who was unlike any wolf he had ever seen. Even before 21 left his natal pack, Rick had known he was unusual. One morning in the spring of 1997, 2 years after Doug Smith and Carter Niemeyer rescued 21 following the death of his father, Rick watched the handsome young wolf returning from a hunt. With him was the big male who had become the pack's new alpha when 21 was still a tiny pup. The pair had killed an elk, and 21, already an outstanding provider, had brought a massive piece of meat back to the den where a new litter of pups had been born. The pups, his new brothers and sisters, showered him with affection, but 21 seemed tense, pacing back and forth across Rick's scope. Finally, the wolf found what he was looking for, a troubled pup that he had recently taken an interest in. There was usually one pup who held the lowest rank in a litter's pecking order, but this pup was different. He had some physical problem that held him back. Rick couldn't tell exactly what was wrong with him, though his litter mates clearly recognized that he was different and shunned him. But 21 seemed to have empathy for the pup, the way a dog seems to know when his owner is feeling depressed or lonely. As Rick looked on, the strapping 21 played with the tiny wolf as though he were still a pup himself, giving him the attention he so seldom enjoyed from his siblings. This capacity for empathy was one of the qualities Rick loved most about wolves. As a pup, 21 had been reared by a father who was unrelated to him, but still felt compelled to provide for him and his siblings. In turn, 21 found himself caring for pups who were not his own when he stepped into 38's place as the leader of the Druids. It was very unusual in the animal world, except among canines and humans. Wolves had an evolutionary imperative to become attuned to the emotions of others because they lived in packs, where cooperation, for hunting, for protection from rivals, was paramount. Sociability enhanced the chances for survival. Over years of watching wolves, Rick had become convinced that empathy was the single most important trait that an alpha could have, and 21's capacity for it continued to amaze him. After 21 became the leader of the Druids, Rick watched him win many territorial battles. He'd once fought off 5 intruders single-handedly. But he'd never seen him actually kill a wolf. His mate was the same way. Unlike that of the sister she had helped depose, 42's rule was a benevolent one. In 2002, the enormous pack split apart, with the various factions forming at least 3 new packs in areas south and west of the Lamar Valley, while 21 and 42 maintained control of their original territory. Alpha wolves with druid lineage were now spread throughout the northern range, including the female who would eventually lead the Agate Creek pack and give birth to 06. To Rick, the druids were like the Kennedys, American royalty. By the end of the first decade after reintroduction, dispersing wolves were showing up in far-flung wilderness areas where they hadn't been seen in generations, making headlines on a regular basis. The project even had its first celebrity wolf, a druid whose remarkable ramblings were reported in newspapers nationwide. He was part of the enormous brood of 21 pups that enthralled watchers in the spring of 2000. Although his official collar number was 253, Everyone called him Limpy, thanks to an injury to his left hind leg he'd sustained as a puppy. Even with his bad leg, he thrived, growing up to become a barrel-chested black wolf with a dark mask across his eyes and a distinctive hopping gait that made him instantly recognizable through a scope and endeared him to watchers. Had any misfortune befallen his father, 21, Limpy would have been a likely candidate to replace him as alpha male. But 21's reign never faltered, and that meant Limpy had to leave the Lamar Valley to have a chance to establish his own pack. In mid-October 2002, Rick noticed that Limpy's signal hadn't been detected for several days running. He had finally made his move. 6 weeks later, a coyote trapper checking his snares in the hills outside a town in Utah found he'd caught something far too large to be a coyote. There hadn't been a confirmed wolf sighting in the state in over 70 years, but the trapper knew one when he saw one, even if the rancher he was working for initially didn't believe him. The wolf he'd caught was still alive and wearing a research collar. Word quickly reached Yellowstone. Limpy had been found, almost 300 miles from the Lamar Valley. Rather than carry him all the way back to Yellowstone, officials with the Fish and Wildlife Service decided to release him in Grand Teton National Park, about 125 miles north of where he was captured. A few packs had already been established in Grand Teton by dispersing Yellowstone wolves, but it still offered plenty of opportunities for an ambitious young wolf looking for his own territory. Limpy, however, had his own agenda. 11 days after he was dropped off in the far northern end of the park, his signal was picked up east of Yellowstone Lake, some 40 miles away. He was headed home. On December 20th, Limpy was back with his clan in the Lamar Valley. In a little over 2 months, he had completed a remarkable round trip of more than 1,000 miles. It was the kind of story newspaper editors loved, and Limpy's homecoming saga was reported far and wide. But he didn't stay in the park for long. He spent the next few years roaming southwestern Wyoming until researchers eventually lost track of him. Rick thought of Limpy often over the years and told his story to countless park visitors. It was fun to imagine him out there, somewhere in the West, following his nose wherever it might lead him. It was still a world hostile to wolves. Over the years, the project had lost so many to poachers, to traffic, to ranchers protecting livestock. But Limpy seemed blessed. 42's tenure as the matriarch of the world's most celebrated pack ended on February 1, 2004. She was killed on top of Specimen Ridge by invading wolves from the same pack the Druids had driven out of the Lamar Valley 8 years before, when she was just a pup. Now known as the Molly's Pack, the wolves had flourished after their exile to the park's interior, though they made periodic forays north when the snows got too deep and the game too scarce in their home territory. This time they had caught 42 wandering alone. At nearly 9 years of age, she was no match for them. She'd been the last of the park's remaining Canadian-born wolves. Her death, if not peaceful, had at least been a natural one, and for that, Rick was grateful. In the weeks that followed, he watched as 21 roamed the valley, howling for his missing mate. He had become an old wolf, his black coat gone almost completely silver with age. He found another mate that spring, a young female in the pack who was unrelated to him, and sired one last litter. One day in June, Rick watched as 21 lounged in the pack's summer rendezvous, surrounded by several generations of his offspring. Suddenly a bull elk appeared in the meadow, and a number of the younger wolves leaped up to give chase. The old male stood too, but declined to join the pursuit. It was the last time Rick saw 21 alive. Over the next few weeks, he searched in vain for him as the Druids moved through the valley. Old alphas sometimes wandered off when they were no longer up to the task, ceding their duties to younger males. The battery in 21's collar had died long ago, however, so there was no way to know where he'd gone. Then, one afternoon in July, an outfitter who guided horseback tours in the valley turned in a radio collar to park rangers. He'd found a dead wolf high up on Specimen Ridge, he said. The collar was old and worn, but the serial number on the inside confirmed it had belonged to 21. The next morning, Rick and Doug Smith set out on horseback up the Specimen Ridge Trail to retrieve his body. Following the outfitter's directions, they found him lying under a copse of pines, not far from a tree that he and his longtime mate had scent-marked hundreds of times together over the years. There he was, the wolf who had begun the druid's story. It was the first time Rick had ever actually touched 21's fur, or seen him at such close range. Rick mourned 21's death for a long time. In the years he'd watched the wolf, he felt he'd learned everything there was to know about him, his quirks, his moods, his strengths and weaknesses. He could guess what 21 would do before he did it. Rick liked to tell visitors that 21 never lost a fight and he never killed a vanquished rival. In fact, Rick sometimes called him Superman, because he'd always felt that 21, of all the wolves he'd known, had the perfect blend of valor and nobility. He hung a poster-sized print of the enormous silver male on the wall above his writing desk in his cabin. Captured at full sprint, he appeared to be flying. Chapter 3 A Star is Born. 06 had been howling for days, and at last it had paid off. Atop a partially forested knoll on the western edge of Little America, she stood nose to nose with two young black wolves, a pair of roaming brothers who had only recently made a tentative stab at joining the ranks of the druids. They were both yearlings, though one was noticeably larger, already over 100 pounds, with room on his lanky frame for more if he continued to eat well. The bigger brother had a salt-and-pepper muzzle and a white blaze on his breast shaped like a cross. He was acutely interested in 06, sniffing her as she stood still, tail held high, and allowed herself to be inspected. But it was the smaller of the brothers who was clearly in charge, and he was the one 06 wanted. This wolf's jaw was stippled with gray, as were his withers and chest, making him look older and more weathered than his brother, though in reality neither had much experience being away from their natal pack. His eyes were a light tan color, almost yellow. As he stood motionless, transfixed by the female in front of him, the jilted brother approached his sibling at a crawl, first reaching up to lick at his chin, then turning on his back in the snow to gently paw at his face. He looked like an overgrown pup, which wasn't far from the truth. 06 laid her chin across the smaller brother's back. The three of them lingered there on the hilltop, under a cobalt blue sky, three interlopers far from home, and considered one another. It was late January 2010, 6 weeks after the druids had run 06 off the elk she had brought down, not far from where she stood now. In the interim, her fellow travelers, her sister and her mate, had carefully kept their distance from the druids. They were leery of a clash, but 06 had been creeping closer and closer to the pack whenever she could find them. No matter how often the druid females chased her off, she always returned, drawn by the presence of the two new males. When she couldn't see them, she howled for them, and lately they had begun howling back. But so had the female druids, and their call had not been a welcome, but a warning. The druids had suffered a reversal of fortune in recent months. In the 5 years since 21's death, the pack had held its own, but never enjoyed the stability it had once known. A succession of alpha pairs came and went, and the pack's size fluctuated. Out of 9 pups born to the Druids the previous spring, not a single one had survived. Worse, they had lost their alpha female in the fall, killed by wolves from another pack. White Line, the 3-year-old black who had moved in on O6's elk, had now assumed the role, but 480, the alpha male, was her father, so they weren't likely to breed. The pack needed fresh blood. Now an even more immediate problem had emerged. Every wolf in the pack had mange. The disease, which is carried by mites and causes hair loss, is common among wolves and isn't necessarily debilitating as long as it is confined to a few patches. If it spreads out of control, however, it can become fatal. A wolf deprived of its winter coat can't survive for long in the deep snow of Yellowstone. Rick had been monitoring the pack's health for weeks, watching as they chased O6 around Little America. At first, he'd been concerned for the intrepid female's welfare. Now, however, he was more worried about the fate of her pursuers, some of whom had lost a good portion of their fur. With more of their energy spent just trying to stay warm, the Druids were getting weaker and weaker, less able to chase prey and feed themselves. A few were already too feeble to hunt, and if their situation didn't improve, they might soon be unable to travel at all. The females could not afford to lose the 2 brothers, who had appeared out of nowhere a few weeks before, a pair of black angels in their hour of need. They offered the prospect of an infusion of vitality and, with breeding season approaching, the possibility of a new alpha male and a litter of pups come spring. Another generation of hunters and fighters, a chance to hold on to the Lamar Valley for one more year. O6 wandered down off the knoll to the west, and the brothers followed. White Line had been lingering just out of sight on the far end of the knoll with 2 of her sisters, oblivious to the encounter taking place nearby. Suddenly the Druids seemed to realize that they could no longer smell the 2 males. They began trotting west to investigate. O6 was halfway up a neighboring ridge when the trio appeared far below, 3 black wolves in a line, scent trailing her and the 2 males. Hers was a smell they had become very familiar with, and they were never pleased to find it. Now she raced across the face of the ridge and down through the forested slopes on its far side, heading for a low spot in the Lamar River known as Buffalo Ford. The brothers followed hesitantly. Even in their weakened state, the Druids managed to close the distance, and for a moment the brothers seemed torn between their new acquaintance and the pack they had recently adopted as their own. Eventually, the smaller black peeled off and headed back toward the Druid females. His brother chose instead to follow O6 as she headed south across the frozen river. The Druids had no real chance of catching O6, who almost seemed to be enjoying the chase. The running they had already done had cost the pursuers energy they couldn't afford to spend. Having recovered at least 1 of their males, the 3 sisters clustered, exhausted, in the lee of a basalt cliff. One of them collapsed in the snow, while White Line, whose mange was too severe to lie down on such an icy bed, stood over her, trying to nap standing up. Before long, she tipped over onto the sleeping wolf beneath her. She managed to right herself, then fell again. Her sister licked her gently until White Line stood once more, her snout pointed down, her mangy tail a limp black rope. O6 led her remaining prize up to the top of a prominent butte and then paused on an exposed ledge where the pair bedded down. She had chosen a spot with a commanding view of Little America, less than a mile from where her pursuers were resting. Why had she stopped? She had found a willing mate, albeit not perhaps her first choice, and she was on the far western edge of Druid territory. She had only to lead the male a bit farther away from her rivals, and she'd be home free, with the prospect of starting her own pack in a territory relatively unvisited by neighboring clans. Yet she lingered. She had been playing hide-and-seek with the Druids for weeks, gambling with her life on a daily basis for a chance to be near the two new males. In the meantime, she had eaten reasonably well, taking down a number of elk, sometimes in tandem with her sister and her sister's mate, sometimes on her own. Killing an elk without the assistance of other pack members was a dicey proposition, one that many lone wolves never managed at all. Even when an entire pack hunted together, most chases didn't end in success, and some ended in disaster. Fleeing elk can kick backward with lethal force without breaking stride. Elk that stood their ground, relying on their superior size and, in the case of bulls, their dangerous antlers for protection, were seldom taken either. But 06, since leaving her natal pack, had become surprisingly adept at single-handedly bringing down prey. She was an excellent hunter. What she needed was a piece of land where she didn't have to risk her life every time she went looking for a meal. Little America was good habitat, but most of it belonged to the Druids, and the Druids did not tolerate trespassers. At least, that had always been true in the past. The game 06 had been playing would likely have been fatal during the Druids' heyday, but those days were long gone. In 2 months of chasing 06, this generation of Druids had never come close to catching her. She should have been dead by now, but here she was. Not only alive, but the healthiest, most vital wolf for miles around. High on her perch, 06 seemed to be waiting for the smaller male, bedded far below with the miserable Druid females, to make a decision. She didn't howl, but it seemed she didn't need to. After a brief respite, the male stood up and wandered a short distance away from the resting females, his nose to the ground. He caught the scent he was looking for, and moments later, he was gone. The Druids, too exhausted to follow, howled helplessly. When the black reached his brother and 06, there were warm greetings all around, as if the three had been together for years. Shortly thereafter, as the Druid's unanswered howls echoed off Specimen Ridge, the trio set out together once again. 06 paused to urinate. Instead of squatting, she raised her leg to scent mark a tree, then scratched the earth nearby, lest her sign be missed somehow. It was the mark of an alpha female, and its message was unmistakable. This land is mine. The two males inspected her mark, then added their own on top. They were hers, too. 8 days later, Doug Smith darted the two males from a helicopter. The larger, puppyish black became known as 754. His dominant brother was now 755. Smith would have liked to collar 06, too, but she had an uncanny knack for dodging his efforts. Most wolves seemed to lose their wits when the roaring machine appeared overhead, running flat out, with heads down, without regard for strategy or cover. But 06 was different. She watched the chopper as it came around and seemed to anticipate which way the pilot would turn. It wasn't just Rick who considered her to be a special wolf. Smith had noticed her, too. Over the weeks that followed, the three companions became inseparable, and Smith began referring to the new would-be pack as 755's group. There was no doubt that 755 would become the alpha male. He jealously shepherded his brother away from 06, pinning him time and again when he seemed to get too interested. 754 never failed to submit promptly, and the conflict never escalated. If the trio stayed together long enough to produce pups, he'd become an uncle, but would likely never get to breed 06 himself. He'd have to leave the pack someday, if he wanted a mate of his own, though as Rick watched him rolling on the ground beneath 755, or deferentially squatting to urinate in his presence, it was hard to imagine him as an alpha. 755 might have outranked his brother, but it was clear to Rick that 06 was very much in charge of the new outfit she had assembled. Now nearly 4 years old, she had seen a great deal in her time, while the males still had a lot to learn. Hunting was the first lesson. Now that the two males were collared, the group was much easier to locate, and there were many opportunities to watch them chasing elk in both Little America and, increasingly, in daring forays into the Lamar Valley. 06 typically took the lead, flushing herds out of the trees and running them back and forth across the hillsides, testing each elk to find the slowest animal. The two males should have been welcome additions to any hunting party. In a typical pack, large males like 754 provided the muscle for the final takedown, grabbing the elk by the throat and crushing the windpipe after the lighter, more fleet-footed females had run their prey to exhaustion. But 754 and 755 seemed unable or unwilling to follow 06's cues, running in circles or chasing the wrong animal on too many occasions. They were less partners than trainees. A few of the wolf watchers had begun calling them Dumb and Dumber, a moniker that Rick found offensive. Still, even he had to concede that 06's decision to join forces with these two was puzzling. The simple truth was that they were unlikely candidates to be anybody's saviors. One snowy February afternoon, a few lucky visitors watched as 06 came thundering down off a ridgeline on the north side of the Lamar Valley in hot pursuit of a bull elk, her two companions sprinting along behind her. The elk bounded across the road near Buffalo Ranch, heading for the Lamar River beyond. 06 never slowed, but 754 and 755 pulled up when they reached the blacktop, unwilling to cross. 06 eventually took the bull down herself in the river valley below. Still, the two males held back, even after she returned to the road to check on their progress. Only later, under cover of darkness, did they find the courage to cross and join 06 in a meal. The same dynamic unfolded time and again as the winter wore on. 06 tried to lead her charges to every corner of their new territory, only to be thwarted by the northern range's single, solitary road. The males wanted to come with her, but they couldn't conquer their fear of the mysterious surface and its inherent strangeness, oddly elevated and flat, with no cover, smelling like nothing they'd ever known. And, of course, the road was where the cars were and the people. It seemed that whatever pack the brothers had been born into had seldom encountered humans, and they, too, were alien and threatening. To 06, the road meant nothing. She didn't approach people or cars, but she didn't go out of her way to avoid them either. To her, a car was like anything else on the landscape that was neither predator nor prey, like a rock or a tree, or even a bison. It wouldn't harm her, and she couldn't eat it. It was a non-entity. It was a phenomenon Rick had encountered many times. In any given population of animals, some will seemingly be up for any challenge, crossing a road, fording a deep stream, attacking a rival or an unusually large prey animal, and some will not. In fighting dogs, the tendency to rise to a challenge is known as gameness, and it has been a highly coveted attribute cultivated through generations of selective breeding. In wolves, the provenance and the desirability of the trait is less clear. The same fearlessness that might serve an animal well in Yellowstone, where cars moved very slowly and humans were harmless, might be fatal in the world beyond the park's borders. By late winter, 06 was moving boldly through Druid territory and encountering little resistance. Sightings of the Druid clan en masse had become less and less frequent. The pack seemed to have splintered. The alpha male was now gone for good. With his mate dead and no unrelated females in the pack to breed, he had finally wandered off in search of better prospects. The members Rick managed to find were now severely afflicted with mange. Their tails were ropey and pink, their fur shaggy around the shoulders and thin across the back and hindquarters. The sick druids looked more like scrawny, starving hyenas than wolves. In mid-February, a neighboring pack known as the Blacktails killed an elk in Druid territory near Slough Creek at the far eastern end of Little America. The next day, a small group of Druids, starving and unable to take prey of their own, approached the carcass looking to scavenge a meal. They didn't notice that the Blacktails were still in the area, or perhaps they were too desperate to care. 06 was nearby too, and when the Blacktails attacked, she jumped into the melee, singling out Whiteline, her old nemesis. The Blacktails, meanwhile, ganged up on a Druid known as Thin Female. Even in her weakened state, Whiteline was still dangerous, but 06 launched into her with abandon. The two females drove at each other, battling chest to chest, each straining to reach the other's vulnerable neck or flank without exposing her own to counterattack. The parries and counterparries came so quickly that the pair resembled one twisting and lurching mass, half gray and half black. O6's muzzle was dark with blood by the time Whiteline's sisters rallied to her side and drove 06 away, limping as she retreated, looking back over her shoulder at the scene of the battle. The Druid Alpha's flank was bleeding, but she was still upright and moving well. When the battle was over, Thin Female had gotten the worst of it. Rick, who had witnessed the entire confrontation, watched her slouch away, bloodied and battered, and curl up in the snow with her sisters around her. She had avoided lying down on ice or snow all winter because of her mange. Now it seemed she was beyond such considerations. A wolf project biologist found